This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We hope you had a wonderful 4th of July. And to keep you company as you gather up the bunting and scrape clean the grill today, we've got a mix of music and history on Radio Boston. Classical music sweeps through the streets of Dorchester, and a set of stories that bookend America's military history, from the ragtag American insurgents who challenged the British Empire to the United States' current command of the seas and the view of the Navy's highest-ranking officer about what his service must do to stay relevant. And since it's the end of Navy Week in Boston, we'll start there today. Admiral Gary Roughead is the Chief of Naval Operations and a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. As such, he is the president's principal naval advisor. A 1973 graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy, Roughead also served as commandant there and is one of only two officers to have commanded both the U.S. Pacific and Atlantic fleets. We recently spoke with Admiral Roughead, and you might have heard part of that interview last week when we talked with him about the Navy's anti-piracy efforts and Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Here's the second part of that interview.
You know, I think one thing that may surprise people who aren't familiar with the Navy's involvement in both Iraq and Afghanistan is that I believe there are some 14,000 or so sailors on the ground, mostly in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yes.
So given that Afghanistan is a landlocked country and Iraq only has a very small coastline, can you just describe to us what role sailors are playing on the ground in these two theaters?
Absolutely. And I couldn't be more proud of the work that our sailors are doing in Afghanistan and Iraq and even in the Horn of Africa and Djibouti. But in Afghanistan in particular, we have certain capabilities that really are as applicable on land as they are when they come from the sea and coastal areas. Of course, our SEALs are there, our Special Operations Force, and they're in the thick of it there. But we also have explosive ordnance disposal specialists. And as we saw in the war in Iraq and in Afghanistan, the use of improvised explosive devices is a weapon that's being used, and the ability to go in and disarm those devices is something that's extraordinarily important. Intelligence specialists are there working with the ground forces. Of course, we have a medical presence. We have capabilities and skills and a culture of just getting things done that the commanders there appreciate, and we're going to continue to stay in that fight.
We've been hearing for some time, especially in Iraq, for example, that many soldiers, again, are serving multiple tours because the Afghanistan war, for example, is in its 9th, going on 10th year. Right. Has there been something similar in the Navy that multiple tours are being served by sailors in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, I would say that clearly our sailors that are going in and augmenting the Army units are not rotating at the pace that the Army units may be, but our SEALs are seeing a lot of deployments. Explosive ordnance disposal, also a force that's being used extensively and are seeing multiple deployments. We work very, very hard to give them as much time at home as we possibly can, but their skills are needed, their capabilities are needed, and they're rotating quite rapidly.
Is there any concern at your level when you look over the functioning of the entire Navy that those units may be getting stretched thin with these multiple deployments?
Well, we watch that very, very closely, but what we're seeing is often the case of young men and women who come into the military that when they are doing something that they believe is worthwhile, when they are making a difference, that in itself is an inspiration to them. So right now, the tone of the force, what I refer to the tone, is very positive. Retention is very high, and the interest to come in is equally as high.
Well, regarding American naval operations in Afghanistan, I understand that a huge amount of air support for other troops on the ground there comes from offshore. The Obama administration recently backed off slightly from the timeline that it had set out for withdrawing troops. What's the Navy's view on when its engagement in Afghanistan may end?
Well, I think clearly the discussions about withdrawal is that a process would begin in the summer of 11. But, you know, we are a force that is also offshore that provides a great deal of presence in that part of the world. We have had a permanent presence, for example, in the Arabian Gulf for 60 years. The presence that we provide offshore with our aircraft carrier and the airplanes over Afghanistan will likely continue regardless of the numbers of troops that are there because we can have the presence without having to be on another country's soil. And I think that's going to continue for quite some time.
The very fact that the Navy can have a continuous presence there really speaks to both the strength and the size of the force. And on that note, a question about Defense Department funding. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates recently has made some efforts to cut the Defense Department's spending. I mean, for example, last year he cut the Air Force's F-22 aircraft program. And I believe he recently made some remarks in Maryland that made it sound like he's got his eye on the Navy. He noted that not only is the United States naval fleet the largest in the world, but it exceeds that of the next 13 largest navies combined. And he said, "I do not foresee any significant top-line increases in the shipbuilding budget beyond current assumptions. At the end of the day, we have to ask whether the nation can really afford a navy that relies on $3 to $6 billion destroyers, $7 billion submarines, and $11 billion carriers." So your response to Secretary Robert Gates and his assessment on the cost of supporting this Navy?
Well, I think what the Secretary has done is to challenge all of the services to take into account the fact that the economy is being stressed, that at the end of the day, our national security's foundation rests on our nation's economy, and the strength of that economy is really the foundation for the strength of the nation. And so he really has been challenging us to look at the cost of what we do, how much is in what we call the tail and how much is in the tooth. But I would say that we in the Navy have started to go down that path a couple of years ago. We truncated a fairly expensive shipbuilding program because it was not going to give us the capabilities that we needed. We also have a ship class that is ready to begin extensive production. That's one of the least expensive ships we've built. I've also canceled missile programs and underwater vehicle programs that simply were not delivering, and I won't hesitate in the future to cancel more because we have to become as lean and as mean as we possibly can be, and I look forward to doing that.
It's interesting to hear that you've already got your eye on certain projects that just aren't up to snuff in terms of what today's Navy needs. So if Secretary Gates or President Obama were to come to you and say, "Let's shrink this budget a little," do you have any other potential projects that you think could go?
I'm always looking at the best way to put the budget together, and at the same time keeping in mind that we remain a global Navy, and we as a country have global interests, and the ability for us to operate in different parts of the world is one of the things that really drives the size of the Navy. It's not so much that the size of the Navy is there because we're going to have some great cataclysmic sea battle and that you need the overwhelming numbers, but we as a Navy have great interests in the Middle East, the Western Pacific. They're not exactly the most stable places. And when you look at having a particular Navy unit on station, whether it's a ship or a submarine, you also have a couple of more that are in training and in maintenance that are getting ready to go, and that tends to drive the size of the Navy as well. But also an element in the size of the force and how we deploy the force, and it is the essence of who we are, and that's people. When we ask our people to go forward and spend 6 months away from their families, we want to be able to bring them back and give them a reasonable amount of time back home. So your size is generated by that as well. And our job and my job is to make sure that we get it sized properly for the missions the nation wants us to be able to do, and at the same time to have the force ready, prepared, trained, and have the flexibility in that force to be able to use it wherever and whenever it may be needed.
Well, Admiral Ruffhead, let me ask you about that. Obviously, the types of engagements that the United States is in today is very different than those from 50, 60 years ago, remarkably different. You yourself said there are no cataclysmic naval battles in the middle of the ocean anymore. I mean, the operative word today seems to be asymmetric warfare. Given that, how do you see the Navy's role in the military engagements that the United States is operating in today?
The way I see it is how the Navy is being used. For example, we talked earlier about the air support that we're providing to our troops on the ground in Afghanistan. That's coming from one of our aircraft carriers. We can move that air power very, very quickly, and we don't have to ask anyone for permission to base it. And so the aircraft carrier is still very relevant in the operations that we're doing today. The president recently announced what he called the phased adaptive approach to ballistic missile defense for Europe. The basis for that approach will be our cruisers and destroyers. So even though those are high-end warships, they are fulfilling a need that we need in Europe. They are on station in the Arabian Gulf, and they are on station in the Western Pacific. Our ballistic missile submarines, which are the most survivable leg of our nuclear triad, are constantly on patrol in the world's oceans. Our submarines are in great demand because of the capability that they bring to work against a potential adversary submarine, but they're also kind of the ultimate stealth weapon because they're extraordinarily, extraordinarily hard to find. But yet they provide great intelligence and surveillance and reconnaissance. And then at the same time, we are doing what some would say are some of the softer missions. Mm-hmm. We have a hospital ship that's deployed in Southeast Asia as we speak. It was from a high-end ship, the Bainbridge, that Captain Phillips of the Maersk Alabama was rescued. So even though the ship may operate at the high end, it can still do other things. And my experience over the years has shown me that if you train at the high end, you can still work at the low end. If you train at the low end, sometimes it's hard to go on to that varsity level. And my job is to really prepare and train and design the future fleet so that we can operate across those types of missions that the Navy may expect of us.
Admiral Gary Roughead is the Chief of Naval Operations and a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. You can hear the first part of my interview with Admiral Roughead, where we talk about his take on President Obama's decision to replace General Stanley McChrystal in Afghanistan, and about the Navy's view of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. That's at our website, wbur.org/Boston. Up next, a celebration of the ordinary Americans of the Revolution. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.